Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Rotor Network. My guest today is Tony Bouflides. He's a wildlife biologist, conservation activist, and founder of LifeNet Nature, a mom-and-pop nonprofit devoted to wildlife research, volunteerism, and advocacy. For more than a half century, Tony has witnessed ongoing destruction of wildlife and nature in numerous countries. His conclusion, efforts to mitigate human impacts have fundamentally failed. The only sane way forward is to vastly scale down humanity's exploitation of nature, consumption, and population. His book, Slipping Through Our Hands, Imperiled Wildlife of the Greater San Juans, appeared in 2000. You'll hear more about his background as he explains how that book came about. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you very much, Derek. I'm very happy to be here.
So let's start by talking about the San Juans and where they are, what is their ecological history and who lives there, especially plants and animals and fungus.
Wow, that's a tall order. Let me just tell you where the San Juan Mountains are. Actually, my interest and the book relates to what we're calling the Greater San Juans, and that includes the deserts, the Colorado Plateau areas, and some of the big valleys like the San Luis Valley, as well as parts of northern New Mexico. So we're talking about a very substantial area in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico. For those listeners that might be familiar with the area, the book addresses a landscape, a huge landscape that basically surrounded by Black Canyon of the Gunnison near Montrose, Colorado, on the northwest, on the northeast, Great Sand Dunes National Monument, to the southwest, Taos, New Mexico, and to the southeast, I'm sorry, that's Taos, New Mexico, and to the southwest, Chaco Canyon, and a little bit further north, Mesa Verde National Park. So the reason that was chosen was because of the fact that I realized early in my career that if we're going to conserve wildlife and nature, we're going to have to conserve large natural regions or ecoregions. So let me before I get into some of the animals that are addressed and plants that are addressed in the book, let me give you some background on how this all came about and became part of my life. The year was 1979. The place was Boulder, Colorado. And the actual location was a small graduate student office at Colorado State University. And I was the graduate student, and I overheard a conversation, which I'll tell you about in a minute. At that time, I was finishing up my doctorate on an endangered deer called the huemul in the Andes of South America, principally in Chile. And I had gotten back from 2 years down in South America. And so I'm working on my dissertation, and I heard somebody comment that a grizzly bear was killed by a hunter in the San Juan Mountains. And I said, that's weird. That's what I said to myself. And I thought, gosh, I thought grizzly bears had been exterminated from Colorado for many years. In fact, they were. The last known grizzly bear in Colorado was in 1951. So you can see this was very unusual and outright weird. I didn't think too much about it at the moment because I was obviously busy, wrapping up my dissertation. But a number of years later, a guy by the name of Mike Figgs, he was with the Boulder County Nature Association. He and I were out talking over a beer about the problems of conservation and what we foresee down the road. And we discussed that you really need to protect whole ecosystems or whole landscapes if you're going to save wildlife and nature. And so we published a paper called the Colorado Ecosystem Conservation Project. I mean, it was kind of a grandiose vision, but a necessary vision that would look at the project itself would look at the basic ecoregions of Colorado. That would include the Colorado Plateau, of course, the Rocky Mountains, right? And the prairies and some of the small desert areas that are in Colorado, a lot of people don't even know about. So, and then we would work with a team to identify areas within each of those larger ecoregions that would be suitable for conservation and restoration. I'm talking about real conservation and restoration, not the multiple use kind of stuff that usually involves quasi conservation and often fails. So anyway, we went ahead with that project. It was tough getting started, but we decided to go ahead and do a pilot project because Mike knew the San Juans. I'd never been there at that time, and we're talking the late 80s now. So he'd invited me to take a trip with him down to places like Durango, Colorado, and Pagosa Springs, and talk to local conservationists and people who are interested in preserving nature to see what we could do to get this ball rolling. In the meanwhile, I had had some temporary work at the University of Colorado, engaging students in a number of wildlife projects. So I thought this was a great opportunity to involve them in doing some surveys of natural features and habitat types and to map all this stuff out. And I thought, heck, let's focus on grizzly bear habitat, right? And the reason it was not just what I heard in 1979 about the last grizzly bear being killed. She was an old female. It was really tragic. You know, this poor animal. She was toward the end of her life. Her teeth were worn down, and she had osteoporosis from the analysis of her remains. And she also had genetic signals that indicated that, in fact, she was part of the original grizzly bear population of the Southwest, specifically the San Juan Mountains, and that therefore she was a genetically unique individual. At this point, you know, in the late 80s, we weren't even sure if she was in fact the last. I think today it's pretty much apparent that she was indeed that. So I was inspired by John and Frank Craighead. You and many of your listeners, especially of the older generations, recall the Craighead's pioneering studies on grizzly bears in Yellowstone. And at that time, I knew them fairly well. And at that time, there was a big controversy going on in Yellowstone about further development in the park and the harshness that the Park Service and the federal agencies came down on grizzly bears after they closed the dumps that were, in effect, an eco center where the bears used to come and feed. And in a sense, it kept them out of trouble with people that continually were encroaching on their habitat. So the Craighead's and I, along with a bunch of other people, we were involved in a lawsuit. We wanted the Park Service to not do a major new development in the park. And if they were to insist they go forward with this project, it was called Grant Village, for those of you who visit Yellowstone National Park. And they were supposed to pull out the other development nearby at Fishing Bridge. And they decided they weren't going to do that. In other words, they're going to leave both developments. So there was a lawsuit. Eventually, we won. But I'm giving you that background just to let you know how my interest in the grizzly bears developed and how I wound up taking that interest with me to the San Juan. So in 1989, yes, 10 years after I heard about the death of that grizzly.
You know, I mentioned before we went on air that I grew up in Colorado, in Boulder, and yes. I know this is a long time ago, 42 years, but I could be wrong. You know, memory is strange, but I think I remember a newspaper article about that grizzly bear being shot at some point.
Yeah, very definitely. I mean, it did receive coverage at the time.
I think, you know, this is just one of those small world things. I think, I mean, there are reasons I was already an environmentalist, but that particular article or that particular shooting actually strengthened my resolve to protect wild nature. That's very interesting that, you know, we're having this conversation 42 years later and it influenced both of us.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Derek. And, you know, it also helped me, you know, consider my career trajectory at that time. I became a biologist with the belief, some people might even say it's an old-fashioned belief, that conservation, first and foremost, is about addressing the specific needs of wildlife. And when I say wildlife, I'm talking about everything, you know, plants, animals, you know, all kinds of animals, fungi, everything. Special needs and special places. And if we're going to go ahead and, you know, even talk about conserving nature, we have to take the advice of really the father of wildlife conservation in North America, and that's Aldo Leopold, because he believed in that animals and plants and their communities should be the first focus of conservation. Now, you can compare that with all this talk that you hear about, oh, we have to protect ecological processes and simulate nature, you know, through agricultural systems and on and on. So I just want to throw that in, but I really appreciate what you're saying because it had inspired me and gave me the foundation for moving ahead with a career that I think that I'm happy to have pursued. But anyway, just getting back for a minute to the Craig Hazanet paper. Well, anyway, we did a really detailed, the students did an incredible job. I had a number of people from Boulder and elsewhere in Colorado helping out. We did a biological assessment of habitat suitability for the grizzly bear in the San Juans. And the conclusion was that, yes, there are units of high quality habitat for grizzly bears, but, and that included an unusual lower elevation ring around the San Juans consisting of gamble oak, which produces produces a tremendous amount of acorns. And that's something the Northern Rockies don't have. So this habitat in the San Juans had properties that you don't find anywhere else in the world for grizzly bears. So that's the grizzly bear story part. I know you want to hear how this book actually came around, but I think that by explaining my own personal evolution, so to speak, it helps you understand why a character like me would go ahead and put out this kind of a book called Slipping Through Our Hands, Imperiled Wildlife of the Greater San Juans.
Oh, I'm really glad that you gave the background. So keep going, please.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, I continue with students both from the University of Colorado in Boulder and from the School for Field Studies. That's an East Coast based organization in doing these surveys and mapping. And we actually expanded our analysis to a wide range of other species. And another paper came out of that. Now, I had to figure out, you know, since, you know, we have in the United States, we have our national parks, which are fairly small units with few exceptions, like some of the ones in Alaska and Yellowstone Grand Tetons. But most of the national parks, like Mesa Verde National Park, I mentioned, are really quite small and are not complete landscapes or ecosystems for wildlife. And so I had to come up with another kind of a concept. And the only one that was really available at that time was this biosphere reserve concept, where you would take a very substantial area and you would try to harmonize the relationship between wildlife and people. And you would have core areas that were essentially left alone for wildlife, because those were essential to for the well-being and survival of the most sensitive species, as well as areas that are, you know, very specific places for some of the endemic plants that don't occur anywhere else, right? So a paper came out of this called Applying the Biosphere Reserve Concept to a Greater Ecosystem, and this was the San Juans. We looked at the potential to restore the entire flora and fauna. It was pretty exciting stuff. I was always excited about this broader vision conservation, rather than constantly putting band-aids and trying to mitigate with limited success most of the time the damage that we've caused to the ecosystem. So we looked at things like not only grizzly bears, wolverine, lynx, river otter, black-footed ferret, bison, and 50 odd species of plants and so forth. So and meanwhile, I should say that, you know, well, we were wondering how's the public? I mean, how's the average Joe out there in the San Juan Mountain region, which I really fell in love with, like you know the area, you know the great natural beauty to it, and you don't want to see it despoiled. So that's the way I felt. And so I teamed up with Earthwatch. That's another organization that's based in the East. It's quite famous. It recruits volunteers to go on projects related to the environment, obviously, thus the name Earthwatch. And so I got with a guy at Yale University, fairly well-known conservationist sociologist, the late Stephen Kellert, and he helped me organize a random survey of residents of the San Juans. And so I did about, with the help of these Earthwatch volunteers, about 230 interviews. These weren't just short, you know, 5-minute things. These went on for a half hour, 45 minutes. And, you know, what came out of those interviews really sticks with me today. Number one, the people in this area, by and large, had a strong preference for rural communities and small towns. That's why they weren't living in the big cities, obviously, and for open space and natural areas. They had a great deal of skepticism and general approval of high levels of population and urbanization. Now, at that time, there was a governor of Colorado. You remember this guy probably, Roy Romer. And he was a Democratic governor, and he was considered to be a progressive, more or less, of the times, and that was in the 1980s. And he went around, after he was about ready to retire, giving speeches about smart growth, right? How we had to do growth and development intelligently, and how this would essentially solve our problems of urbanization, habitat fragmentation, the destruction of rural communities, and so forth. And, you know, I went to one of his presentations, and I raised my hand at the end, and I said, Governor, but, you know, what's going to limit growth? Because overgrowth kills wildlife, destroys nature, and changes the rural culture. And he said, well, there's nothing you can do about that. I said, oh, no, there is. You just apply the rules of planning in a very vigorous way, and you can limit level off growth. Of course, he didn't respond to anything. It was for the next question. He went on to the next question, right? But I learned from people in the San Juans, and the great majority favored some kind of a regional conservation plan. I learned from them that what they wanted, they were not going to get. Because if you go back to the San Juans today, and I was there about, I guess, 2 years ago, you will see an entirely different environment from what I saw in the 1970s and 1980s and even in the 1990s. Not that it's completely ruined, not by any means. But for example, Derek, you might remember the Wiminooch Wilderness. That's in the main stem of the San Juans. Well, right at the base of that wilderness, there was a large area of open range that was wintering air, that was a vast wintering area for all the elk, deer, and some of the bighorn sheep. They used to come down to lower elevations during the winter. Well, you go there now, and it's nothing but subdivisions. I mean, it's really tragic. You know, you think about, my God, people are just crowding nature out. It's as simple as that. And by the way, those folks that we interviewed, they ranked, this would be of special interest to listeners who know the San Juans or are interested in visiting it or even live there. People ranked the San Juans second only to Yellowstone as a natural area or one of cultural significance in the entire United States. So that was a reflection of how much people really appreciated the San Juan Mountains as they naturally were. So, okay, about the book. Are you ready, Derek, to talk about the book? I'm sorry for this long introduction, but I think it was informative.
Oh, no. Honestly, what I've been thinking for the last 5 minutes is how much joy it brings me to speak to old school environmentalists. And we don't need to go this direction, but one of the things I've written extensively about is how so much environmentalism has been converted from being about protection of wild places and wild beings to that sort of Roy Rohmer pseudo, well, it's just crap about smart growth. And it is old school environmentalists are my people. And it just, so I was, don't apologize. And it makes me very happy to just be having this conversation.
Well, I very much appreciate that. I think what really triggered me with the book, it's basically a little guide. It's not very long. It's kind of, you could stick it in your pocket. I guess it's about 300 pages. And it was intended to be, I guess, a supplement to field guides, plants and animals of southern Colorado. But what triggered it for me was I had a rancher during the time when we were doing the interviews ask me, well, exactly how many species are endangered and what are those species? And of course, the question kind of caught me off guard. You know, I just started rolling out a number of names like river otter and western toad off the top of my head. And then I realized, hey, wait a minute. You know, I'm the wildlife biologist, right? And I should know this stuff. I don't even know how many threatened, endangered, imperiled animals and plants there are in the San Juans. So I thought, well, there's the field guide idea. Maybe I ought to put this thing together. And, you know, I had so much information from the students. I basically used them as slave labor to do profiles, and they learned a lot. I mean, they enjoyed being slaves. I'm sure they did. I get great feedback over the years from former students about looking at the detailed lives of these creatures, some of which nobody ever heard of, really. There are in the book profiles, and they're fairly short. They're usually like 2 to 4 pages, right? There are 110, and 45 are animals and 55 are plants. And out of that 110, 26 of those occur only in the San Juans. They are what we call endemics, right? So there was another 100 species in the appendix that were species that at that time I felt bear watching, because they could become imperiled in the foreseeable future, especially if these these negative habitat trends continue. So, and then there were a bunch of animals and plants that were lost as wild species. I mentioned the grizzly bear is gone, bison, gray wolf, black-footed ferret. Some were globally extinct, nowhere to be found, like Wolf Creek evening primrose. I loved Wolf Creek. You go out of Pagosa Springs and you go up the valley, Wolf Creek Valley there, and you go over the divide. Great, beautiful country. But that plant is no longer with us, unfortunately. And there were several others like Colorado watercress and small flowered penstemon. So it's important to know about these plants, because it's tragic and they can never be recreated. And their lives and the meaning of their lives has been lost forever. So, you might wonder, well, what's the problem in the San Juans? What was it then and what is it today? So in the book, and by the way, if anybody's interested in a copy, I still have some copies left. I can tell folks how to get them by just contacting me directly. But anyway, I looked at, there's a table one that discusses shows what the main threats are, and 67 species out of 110 were affected by land development directly, and we're talking about subdivisions, right? Road building and the like. That was number one for animals, excluding fish. Livestock was the biggest one for plants. 61 species overall threatened by livestock and livestock overgrazing and degradation of habitat. And thirdly, as you would expect, number one for fish was water, so-called water development. And then so on down the line. And climate change was mentioned for 18 species. This is back in 1999 is when I actually finished writing the book. Climate change was mentioned for 18 out of the 110, and affecting 10 animals and 6 plants. So before I go on, I mean, do you have any further thoughts or questions that you might want to kick around?
Just very quickly, how much were buffalo there, and when were they eradicated, and how far southwest did the buffalo go?
Well, let me tell you what the fact. I'll just flip to the profile of bison, and that'll answer your question, and then I can say a bit more. If you spot a bison in the San Luis Valley, it's no mirage. But you might wonder about time travel. Bison were hunted there by the Ute Indians when Don Juan de Onate arrived at the junction of the Rio Grande and Rio Chama in the late 1500s, beginning the official entrada of Europeans into the region. Nearly 200 years later, Don Diego de Vargas reported about 500 bison near San Antonio Mountain at the valley's south end. That's where the San Luis Valley extends into northern New Mexico, just north of Taos. While today bison are not free roaming in the San Luis Valley, those that may be seen are part of a sizable captive herd near Sand Dunes National Monument. So that, you know, there's a debate about, I think it's generally accepted that bison occurred to the Rio Grande in the Southwest with smaller bands that crossed the Rio Grande into other parts of the Southwest. You know, in the San Juan Mountains, it really broke my heart because Mike Figgs pointed out to me some unusual things in the soil, where the soil was kind of bare. This is on the lower slopes of the San Juan Mountains. And he said that those are old buffalo wallows. Can you imagine that? And then we discussed that, and he said, yes, in fact, bison skulls have been dug up in and around the San Juan Mountains. So they were clearly native to the San Juans. And as I said in the book, there's certainly, if people wanted them back, they could get them. I suggested, I'll just read this, experiment with establishing free-ranging herds. And then explain how this could be done cooperatively. Obviously, it's a big benefit. It would be a big benefit to tourism. There's a lot of cultural value, especially among the indigenous peoples. The area around San Antonio Mountain, I don't know if you've ever been to the top of that thing. It's really amazing. You look out over Taos, the lower valley. You look out toward the beautiful San Juans, the shining mountains, much of the year with snow on the tops. It's really the San Juan Serengeti. And so I had proposed restoration of bison and a number of other species to that wonderful ecosystem. So that, I hope, answers your question about bison.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And presumably, I mean, when bison come back, then that would also help draw the predators for them. It would help draw all sorts of other species dependent on bison. And I know, for example, in the Dakotas, I don't know about in the San Juans, but I know in the Dakotas, they're incredibly important for migrating waterfowl, and also for all sorts of amphibians, because their wallows hold water and mud through parts of the year and become stop off points for the waterfowl and become year round habitat for many amphibians. So I'm presuming that we could see the same thing there.
Yeah, there's you're absolutely right. I appreciate those insights. There's a lot of things that are missing from that area, in addition to the bison in that very same habitat, like the black-footed ferret. There are a lot of other plants that are just about gone. I mean, it's still possible, but I think the window of opportunity is rapidly closing now. I haven't been north of Taos in a while, but I was appalled at some of the sprawl that was occurring all the way up to the Colorado line and into Colorado. So I hate to say it, but I'm not really optimistic right now. I'm not optimistic about anything, but why do I continue as an old timer, old schooler? That's because my heart is in it. And what else am I going to do? Sit around and get drunk, drink a beer every night and go to bed? I mean, the reality is that I love nature, like so many of us do. And my last dying hour, I'll still be speaking out and doing what I can. So, and I think if we all, follow suit, we could potentially see a big change in our society. But we could talk about that for hours and hours, and I hope we can at some point. But nevertheless, no, you're right. You start bringing back keystone species like the bison, and a lot of things start moving in the right direction.
So is there any realistic possibility? And I know, okay, I'm going to back up, and I completely hear you about the urban sprawl. And, you know, as I've said before, I grew up in Boulder, and I rarely go back. And when I do, my heart is completely broken, because Well, this isn't going to mean anything to listeners, but it'll mean something to you, that when I lived there, Louisville, Lafayette, Longmont were all separate towns, and Broomfield were all separate towns. And Superior and Marshall, Marshall was itsy bitsy, and now there's hotels there. And when I go back to Colorado, it breaks my heart because, one more silly little story. Every year on Valentine's Day, my family would drive up to Loveland so that I could mail a Valentine to my grandmother, and it would be postmarked Loveland. And Loveland was tiny, and I happened to be in Loveland 7 or 8 years ago, and it's huge. It's hard to say how huge without swearing. And I have been a little bit to Durango, and I mean it's all just horrifying. But having given that little speech, I've heard rumors of work being done to bring wolves back to Colorado. And is there any possibility, again, recognizing the habitat difficulty, can you talk a little bit about the possibility of wolves and or grizzly bears coming back? And also, if you want to talk about prairie dogs in the region, too, because isn't there a localized species of prairie dog? Or am I wrong on that?
I think there's a Gunnison prairie dog.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I believe there. I think it's actually in the book. You know, you've really motivated me to pick up this book and to read my own book because it's been many years. You know, I've gone on to other things in my life, but I'm really excited about it. I still have a friend down there. Ironically, my friend, I was in the Peace Corps with him. We were in public health at the time, back in the 60s, right, in Southeast Asia. And he lives right below the Wiminouche in a subdivision, right? So when I go back there, I have to sort of swallow it and not keep my mouth shut because, I mean, that's what people want to do. They love nature. They want to get out. They want to be free and open, live in near nature and open country. And I think that's one of the tragedies. We see it all over the place. I mean, right now in Montana, my goodness, I live in Bozeman, Montana. I've only been living here, since about 2006, on and off. And this town is going crazy. They're calling it Los Angeles. And people are fleeing the very places that we've destroyed nature, right? It's so ironic. It's so pathetic. It is pathetic that this is the human predicament at this day and age, that we can't help ourselves. Remember I was telling you about that survey in the San Juans? Nobody wanted overgrowth, right? They wanted nature. They wanted the rural environment. But what are they getting? They're getting what they don't want. And I think that's also a reflection of this migration toward the last great places, if you want to call them that, like Montana, right? I don't know what's going to happen when I'm gone. I don't know what's going to happen when there's no longer any great places. Everything is so overcrowded. I can go on. I mean, my shock of having to get reservations, not for 2021, but for 2022, for a campsite in Yellowstone National Park, or getting a reservation just to go into Glacier National Park in Montana, one of the states with the lowest population density. Can you imagine that? This is what we're up against. And I don't have any easy solutions other than the fact that the whole bloody human enterprise needs to scale down. And if conservationists continue just talking about mitigation and putting band-aids on the problem, it ain't going to work. And I tell them day in and day out until I'm blue in the face that unless you start talking scale down, we're going to lose it. And, you know, our children, grandchildren, if they're still around, are going to curse us because we didn't see the light. Well, that's my lecture for today.
Well, I completely agree with you. And yes, I completely agree. And this has been clear to me. I guess I'll tell this story, too, that I really became an environmentalist in second grade. So this is 1968, 1967, 69, somewhere in there. And I was, what, 7 or 8 years old. And they put in a subdivision next to where I lived. And before that, it was meadows, and there were meadowlarks, and there were grasshoppers and anthills and garter snakes and, you know, cottonwood trees. And it became exactly what you're talking about. It became white box houses. And I remember thinking in second grade, I didn't have the language to say you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. But the language I did have is, where will these creatures go? Where will these cottonwoods go? If we keep taking their homes, they will have no place else to live. And that was one of the most important happenings of my life in terms of understanding what's happening in the world. And it kind of horrifies me that I understood something when I was 7 years old that a lot of adult mainstream environmentalists who talk about smart growth don't seem to understand as 40-year-olds. And I mean, what you're talking about is not particularly cognitively challenging. And what I talk about is not particularly cognitively challenging. It's not hard to understand that if you take away buffalo, that the species who depend on buffalo won't be there. And if you take away, if you take out water from a river, that will harm the fish. I don't understand how you can have more than 100% of the water in the Colorado River allocated and people still want to allocate more. This makes, I know that I'm just ranting now too, but this makes no sense to me.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, I guess, I think most conservationists and environmentalists are trying to bend over backwards to prove that they are perhaps not radical, that they want to look like, or they want to be accepted by dominant society. So they keep offering these platitudes and saying, yes, we can do, yes, we can do. In the meanwhile, you can continue going around doing business as usual. I don't know. I just think that that's perhaps part of the explanation of the psychology of this. It is quite puzzling.
So let's go back to the San Juans. And and you've talked about grizzly bears, and we've got, I don't know, 7 or 8 or 9 minutes left, and I'm not ready to quite wind down yet, but you started with grizzly bears, so let's move back toward them. And what would you say is the possibility of either grizzly bear re-inhabitation or intentional restoration in the next 30 years in the region? Where are the closest grizzly bears to the area now?
Yes, it's Yellowstone, and that is, a 3-day drive? Not 3 days, I'm sorry, a day and a half drive from the San Juans. No, it's really sad about the grizzly bear. I mean, if you're looking at California as another example, they're gone from California. The golden bear was major feature of the landscape at the time of the arrival of the Spanish.
If you were near a river at the beginning of conquest, the chances are really good you would see a grizzly bear every 15 minutes.
There you go. But when, you know, in terms of the San Juans, first of all, it could be done. But you would have to have a miraculous change in cultural attitudes toward wildlife for that to happen. I don't think that's likely. And the reason I'm saying this, and this is different from the wolf, if you want me to explain why, I think there's a good chance we could have the gray wolf back in the San Juans. But the grizzly bear is different. And the reality is that to live with grizzly bears, you've got to be extremely tolerant. And given the levels of development around the San Juans right now, it's hard to imagine our society becoming, you know, in a relatively short amount of time, assuming that we could stabilize and avoid further growth, that's a huge assumption. It's such a long shot. I hate to say it, but I'm being realistic.
And yeah, you mentioned the difference between that and, well, actually I have another question first, which is where I live in far northern California, Crescent City on the coast. I literally see bears every single day, black bears.
Yes.
And they are a delight, and they're also very destructive of like property, but I don't actually care because I'm living on their home. So one year there was a baby bear who decided to chew on my truck tires. And so I had to replace truck tires, I think, 3 or 4 times that summer. So they destroy stuff, but they're not hard to live with if you don't mind them occasionally tearing a board off your porch, which I don't think is a big price to pay for the joy of seeing them every day. But my point is, our grizzly bears, you said that they require a lot of tolerance. Is it that tolerance that, well, okay, I've got to accept that I'm going to lose a board off my wall once in a while and replace it? Or is it greater? Are grizzly bears harder to live with than black bears?
Oh, absolutely. That's because they're an aggressive animal. They're the dominant. They see themselves as being the dominant animal on the landscape. And they're not gonna take anything from people. They're not gonna take our BS. And if we confront them, especially the females with cubs, she will attack, swat you around, get you down on the ground, and then if there's anything left of you, leave the rest of you, hopefully in one piece, you know, and leave. So they have zero tolerance really for close proximity to people, whereas black bears, you know, they come and go, and they're not super aggressive, although they can be. I mean, people have been attacked by black bears, usually when there's some dispute over food or garbage, right? But grizzly bears, that's a different story. I mean, I travel in the backcountry in Yellowstone all the time, and you know, it's really great to have grizzly bears there. People might say, "What are you talking about, Tony?" Well, it's really great to have them there because it keeps people out of the backcountry. And fortunately, there are large blocks of Yellowstone National Park that are called grizzly bear management units. And essentially, right, they are closed to everybody during significant portions of the year. And that's what you would need in the San Juans. And that's a tough sell politically. I remember trying to convince the local Sierra Club, right? Let's work to get grizzly bears back in the San Juans. And you know, most of the people that do the hiking and stuff, oh no, I don't want those horrible beasts out where I do my favorite hikes. I mean, that's the attitude, you know, that sometimes you come up against, and you say, what? Can't you learn to live with the animals? I will go into grizzly bear country. Many people have in Yellowstone and the Northern Rockies and Alaska. And boy, it adds value to the whole experience. Don't you guys get that? But apparently some people don't and haven't.
Well, that's part of the problem when even the advocates for wildlife are not willing to, are in some cases then primarily concerned about their aesthetic experience rather than the health of the biome.
Yes.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left. And so will you give one final, three things. One of them is one final statement to help people fall in love with the San Juans, with the San Juan region. Second, anything you want to say, I haven't given you the opportunity. And third, if people want to know more about your work, including that book and including your Life Net Nature, can you tell them how to find out more?
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing I want to emphasize is that people who love wildlife and nature, it's important for all of us to become as familiar as we can personally with the species, especially the imperiled species, in our region. You know, we have a pretty good mental image of what's there, but it's nothing like getting out there in the field on the ground and learning and seeing what's going on, you know, especially plants. You know, there's, we don't know, most people don't know a lot about plants. I guess, I mean, they're incredibly attractive, their beauty, I mean, from an aesthetic standpoint. And I know a lot of people are into plants, but they usually think of houseplants or the plants in their garden. And the subtle beauty, and sometimes not so subtle beauty, of wild plants is just amazing. So, you know, if you, you know, if you're the kind of person that really wants to advance the knowledge, and sometimes you can become the expert. I mean, you can contact your friendly botanist, your mammalogist, ornithologist, or herpetologist, or whatever, where you live when you get stumped. But I really encourage people to take up the hobby of being a wilder human being. And, you know, a book like this, and this could be done for essentially any area, any ecoregion, and spread the word, I think. So that's a principal message that I would like to get out. I mean, obviously, it's important to speak out, as we have here in this program, on the bigger issues, you know, the overgrowth problem and what might be done to help solve that. But I mean, there's always hope. And, you know, I encourage people to stay active, stay alert, never get discouraged. As far as the book and LifeNet Nature, LifeNet Nature has a website. My wife leads a lot of the field trips. She's always recruiting volunteers. In fact, tomorrow she's going to Ecuador. She has a bird banding station in the Andes of Ecuador near a town called Mindo, a beautiful little town. And she takes volunteers there. And you just have to go to the LifeNet page and sign up. There's another one upcoming in Kenya, where she's working with a local Maasai tribe on studying and getting protection for giraffe. So anybody who's interested in going out there and walking with the tall ones and taking photographs and documenting their migration and so forth, well, there's an excellent opportunity. It's low budget. As I say, it's a mom and pop operation. So, yeah, that's something to be considered. Yeah, and there you go. And as I say, you can contact me through LifeNet or my wife, Dusty Becker, Dr. Dusty Becker, and I can send you a book on the San Juans if you're interested in going there and enjoying those wild places and having this this book along with your field guides.
And just to be clear, it's lifenetnature.org, and so people can go there.
Yes.
And thank you so much for everything, for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Tony Povilaitis. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.